I've got three stories for you this go-round. Each one bigger, better, and more explosive than the one before it. But before I can tell you any of them, you need to know the legend of Earl Joe Hendershot and his infamous kill car. By all accounts, and even on the best of days, Earl Joe Hendershot was a low-down, no-good, dirty, rotten, bastard son of a junkyard dog. But he was a very well-known man in his neck of the woods. Anybody who didn't know Earl Joe personally still knew who he was by name and by sight. Because around there, Earl Joe was the ace of the dirt track, unbeaten. He was a backwoods bootlegger supreme, uncaught. He was the premier gear jammer for this entire end of West Virginia, undisputed. And, most notably, he was the reigning champion of that foggy stretch of dirt road called Crooked Neck. In this corner of West Virginia, there was never a stretch of road that was more infamous than Crooked Neck. It was 3.5 turny, twisty miles through choppy foothills and dense forest, a dirt road barely 2 lanes wide. It had long been a favorite for local outlaws and moonshiners. The road itself was very hard to drive, especially for Johnny Law, and there were 1,000 tiny dirt road offshoots that led off in various directions into the deeper woods. For years, Earl Joe was the king of Crooked Neck. Until one day, some idiot cop got into it with him, ended up having a bad turn, rolled into a ditch. Earl Joe drove off and left the cop in that ditch, overturned. Some say that if he knew that idiot cop was down there slowly drowning, that Earl Joe might have helped. Most others say that it wouldn't have mattered if he knew or not, because Earl Joe had never helped a living soul in his life. Either way, when the cop ended up dead, the other cops took it real personal, and they went after Earl Joe hard. They took his house, they busted up all his stills, they impounded his cars, they arrested anyone he did business with. They basically made him untouchable and homeless. All he had left was his hidden garage out in the woods by Crooked Neck, where he retreated to lick his wounds and plan his next move. Whereas most men would have scurried off somewhere, maybe tried to start over, Earl Joe was not most men. Earl Joe never had a girlfriend that he didn't hit, he never had a dog that he didn't kick, and he never met a cop that he didn't hate. And now that the cops had taken his life from him, you can be damn sure that Earl Joe was going to come back hard. And so he did. Earl Joe spent a few days souping up the engine of that muscle car, and he transformed the outside of it into a death delivery system. Metal grating, roll bars, long lines of broken saw blades, jagged strips of metal down each side. A modified cow catcher that he spot welded to the front of the car. It was covered with wrought iron spearheads that he had personally cut from the fence of a Civil War cemetery. Because that's just the kind of son of a bitch that Earl Joe was. Stenciled in blood red letters down each side of the car, it read, "Kill." That night, once the sun went down, Earl Joe drove out looking for a bloodbath. He cruised into town, and he started attacking cops, ambulances, fire trucks, any old Joe Schmo that managed to get in his way. He killed more than a few that night on his wild ride. Once reinforcements came from the state police, Earl Joe rode out through the back roads of West Virginia, leaving a wake of wreckage and human misery behind him, trying to get back to Crooked Neck. He didn't quite make it. Finally, the cops edged him off the road, and he drove through the side of a bridge and into the chasm below. They say Earl Joe hit the stone with such impact that the morgue guys couldn't separate man from machine. It was all a big jumble of gears and hoses and guts and assorted fluids. Ever since that night, Earl Joe Hendershot maintains his dominance as the champion of Crooked Neck. Locals know to never drive that stretch of road at night, because when you drive the neck, then you're challenging Earl Joe. And if you race, you have to win or you die. And now that you know the legend of Earl Joe and his kill car, we can begin the episode proper. This one is a trilogy of fast, furious, and frightening tales that I call Hellbound and Down. Drinking whiskey in the kitchen and telling scary stories around the fire. Music, monsters, and mayhem, killers, cannibals, and cults. Fearful fiction and furious fact, tall tales, and terrible truths. This is A Scary Home Companion. Part 1. Kill Car. Everyone knew to avoid the road. It had been 20 years since Earl Joe died. But it seemed like everyone in West Virginia knew someone who knew someone who had tried to ride the road and had never come back. You never talked to anybody that knew anybody directly that went out to Crooked Neck and lost to Earl Joe, but every friend had a friend, every cousin had a cousin. Everybody knew somebody, but no matter how well-known the stories are, you always get some young punks that think the old stories are just stories. And that is what happened on this particular night. Under the light of a crescent moon, a local bookie named Pinsky was hosting the first race on Crooked Neck in 2 decades. He was holding the pink slips for a main event caliber 3-way race to crown the new champion of Crooked Neck. Sure, the winner got the loser's cars, but more than that, they got the bragging rights. The winner would be the first champion of Crooked Neck since Earl Joe. And you'd think that being the biggest race in years, there would be one hell of a turnout, but there were only a handful of folks there to witness it, and they all stayed back on the pavement of Highway 31, watching from a distance. Local legends all held consistently that since Earl Joe had never been any good driving on pavement, that still held after his death. And so if you didn't go onto Crooked Neck and you stayed on the 2-lane, you'd be fine. That's what they said. This bookie, Pinsky, he'd gotten together the 3 best dirt drivers in West Virginia, at least the 3 best who would agree to race this particular track. There was Gordon Greenbrier, a long-haired drag strip artist with 8 straight wins in local races. Pretty hot stuff. Copper Dave, better known as the Rocket of Kearneysville, was there. And the notorious Leadfoot Lurleen Stokes, with her longtime girlfriend, mechanic, and navigator, Shotgun Janice. Lurleen was a lean, mean gearhead who saw every single win as a way to throw up a huge middle finger salute to her whole family. Lurleen was 19, she was rebellious, and she was the odds-on fave to take the crown. Leadfoot Lurleen was not to be trifled with. Lurleen and Janice both knew the history of the road. They knew all the ghost stories, and they both thought it was old-timey hogwash. The bootleggers and the moonshiners had perpetuated the stories and the myth of Earl Joe over the last 20 years, specifically to keep people out of that neck of the woods. A good ghost story is much better protection than a gun, at least until you run into folks who don't give half a care about ghost stories. Okay, it's about time for the race to start. Everyone edges up to the line. The race is going to start right there at this end of the neck and end 3.5 miles away where it connected with the next paved road. Pinsky had a couple of boys at the other end to gauge the winner. You ready? You ready? Everybody ready already? Pinsky pulls out his gun. three, two, one. A single bullet in the air to kick off this epic race. A single bullet that awoke something out there in the dark woods. Something that heard that starter's pistol and knew that there was a lot more to be won than just a race. Right off the line, the three were neck and neck. All the racers banging into each other, jockeying for position, going for broke. The dirt road is called Crooked Neck because it has a series of very sharp bends in it. And the thick forest runs right up to the edge of the dirt road on both sides, leaving very little margin for error. And I, as much as I would love to give you an intense play-by-play of the race, everything broke down into chaos very quickly. As soon as the racers rounded the second stiff set of corners, they saw someone driving up the roads right towards them. A car with a cowcatcher full of jagged spikes and the word kill painted down both sides. The car flips on a full bank of deer lights mounted on the roof, blinding everyone just for a second. And sorry about your damn luck, Copper Dave. The Rocket of Kearneysville was in the lead at the time, dead center middle of the road, and the kill car ran right through him, tearing the car to shreds down the middle and ripping through it like a table saw. The other two cars stop, swerve, turn around to check on Copper Dave, but there's not much checking to be done. He's so dead, and his car completely ruined. They see the red taillights of the kill car as it drives off into the night. At the start of the run, which is less than a half mile away, Pinsky hears this crash, and he jumps into his car, his instinct to drive out to the crash site and see what happened, but Pinsky's heard all the legends too. If you try and drive the neck, you're asking for a race with Earl Joe. But he's thought of this. He's going to outwit the system. He's just going to walk out there. Good thinking. Gets him like 50 feet before the kill car just comes roaring out of the shadows and runs him down. Pinsky gets hung up on the spikes and he screams for a while. They hear these screams back at the crash site. The screams get closer and closer as the kill car starts to return. The two racers decide to just, all right, call off the contest. We need to work together to get safe. As they're discussing it, window to window, the kill car returns, circling them, stalking them. It seems to disappear into one stand of trees and then appear from another. Obviously, Earl Joe has the edge out here. Gordon and Lurleen and Janice decide there's no way that they're going to sneak out of this. There's only one way to get out. They need to try and race the ghost. If someone's going to get out, they've got to get out as the real champion of Crooked Neck. And maybe, just maybe, Earl Joe's ghost can't move on because no one ever beat him. His pride is that strong. The champ can't retire, right? He's got to be retired. Lurleen and Gordon back up bumper to bumper, facing opposite directions. They're going to try and race him both ways at once. That way, at least one of them will win the race and get away. They tap bumpers. 3, 2, 1, go. They race off in opposite directions. Gordon Greenbrier gets maybe 100 yards before the kill car barrels out of the darkness beside the road and just cuts his car in half, sideways, cutting through Gordon's extended arms and legs in the process, which just go flying. Bad news for Gordon, good news for Lurleen, who now has the narrowest of head starts as the spiked, bloody, flaming kill car whips around behind her and starts tearing up the road, belching brimstone exhaust. The bank of deer lights blind her, so she just rips off her rearview mirror and throws it out the window so she can't see the devil on her heels. They don't call her Lurleen for nothing. And she came this night prepared to win the race. And so, she did what she did best. She focused on the road, and she drove. The kill car edged up right beside her. But she took the cricks in the neck like a champ, like a true ace. And for a second, Earl Joe was lagging behind at her bumper. Seizing the advantage, Shotgun Janice pulled out her sawed-off shotgun that she always kept under her seat, which is why they actually call shotgun seat anyway, because the driver drives and the passenger holds the shotgun. Janice jumps up, sit on the window of the door, and start cranking off shots into the kill car, which seemed to do absolutely nothing. And then the car bumped Lurleen on the side, and she skidded just a bit, and Janice went flying out the window. She hit the dirt, rolling ragdoll style end over end, and didn't have time to roll for very long before the kill car swerved out of its way and ran her down. Lurleen was now crying behind the wheel, but she couldn't slow down. Janice had bought her an extra second, and as she rounded the last bend in the road, she saw the finish line, the place where they had started the race, the end of Crooked Neck, where Penske's car was still parked across the middle of the road. Lurleen cranked the wheel just in time, but still clipped the front bumper, just as the kill car slammed into her from behind, and her car rolled, going 70 miles per hour. She flipped up into the air and landed on her roof. Lurleen crawled out of the wreckage. She felt the pavement under her hands. She was off the neck. Her car had rolled onto Highway 31. And Earl Joe and his kill car was right at the edge of the dirt road, stopping just shy of the pavement. Even though one of her ankles was broken, her foot utterly ruined, Leadfoot Lurleen got to her feet in the bright glare of those deer lights. The kill car revved its engine at her, but she was no longer scared. "I won," she shouted. "I beat you." And then, with a roar of the engine, the kill car sprang forward to run her down, and then faded into dust before it could hit her. Because just like in life, paved roads were Earl Joe's weakness. Lurleen Stokes limped away, hobbled, grieving, but her head was held high because she was the new champion of Crooked Neck. Part 2, Smokey and the Kill Car. The town of Bedford, West Virginia was never big enough to have a bank, but they do have a pawn shop with a very big safe. Rumor had it said safe contained over $20,000 in small bills, which was more than enough justification for a group of local toughs looking for easy money to take interest. There were six of them in total, six young men, among the most low-down and undesirable that that end of West Virginia had to offer. The crew ran three cars deep, each car with a driver and a shooter. They had practiced the routes 100 times, and they knew just how to do it. Once they got into their cars after the robbery, it was going to be a cakewalk. They were going to go in three different directions at once, rendezvous later. That meant, worst-case scenario, only one of them would ever get caught. And today, not even that was going to happen. On this particular day, it was a Friday. They hit it just before closing. The crew hit the store 3 guns deep. Things went a little bit sideways when the clerk got shot, but it didn't seem like it was fatal. So they took the money as planned, split up, 3 different directions, same endpoint. But the local law on this day was a lot faster than they had anticipated. Sheriff Don Kresge was on duty. He sideswiped one of the cars and put it in a ditch. And when the man riding shotgun raised his weapon, Kresge put him down with a sigh. He heard some more gunshots from up the road, and he couldn't raise his deputy. Kresge dragged the driver out of the car, put him face down in broken glass right next to the body of the dead shooter. And he cuffed him and left him there. This kid, this driver, he was only 19, but he had to look his dead friend right in the face as he was laying there. So he spilled the tea. Everybody was going to meet at Earl Joe Hendershot's old garage just off Crooked Neck. The sheriff knew that meant Tully Sampson Hendershot was one of the drivers. Tully was a millennial dog kicker, allegedly bastard kin to Earl Joe through a statch rape case that was never closed. The kid had been trouble his whole life, always trying to live up to the legend of his alleged dad. Kresge's deputy in the other cruiser didn't fare as well as the sheriff did. Said deputy had tried to chase down Tully and had been shot in the process. Sheriff Kresge got there just in time to close the young man's dead eyes and to vow him justice. Kresge knew exactly where they were going, and he felt compelled. He felt he had no choice other than to go after them. Before I continue, I have to say, there are 2 things, very important, that I have not told you about Big Bad Don Kresge. Number one, he was West Virginia state champion of demolition derby for 8 years running, and he never once lost. He just retired when he got elected sheriff because he saw it as a conflict of interest. And 2, he'd been using dynamite to fish for the last 12 or 15 years and gotten so good at it, he'd even learned the process to make TNT for his own self. And these are important facts to know because when Don Kresge left that road and left his deputy's body, he drove home. He parked his cruiser. He pulled the tarp off the car he had won his last 3 championships with, which he'd been playing with and tuning up ever since, making it better than ever. And then he chugged beer. He grabbed a handful of his cheap cigars from that mug he kept on the piano. He gave his wife a kiss. He shared an awkward hug with his only son, who now claimed to be his only daughter, whatever the hell that was supposed to mean. And then Sheriff Don Kresge loaded up a couple of guns and a half a crate of TNT sticks he'd made himself, and he set off to Crooked Neck. He knew about the legend of Earl Joe, and he didn't give half a damn whether it was true or not, because he was loaded for bear. When Tully, his shotgun, and the other car met up at the garage, they immediately knew something had gone sideways. They still had the money with them, but it stung losing a car. It stung more losing 2 friends. They decided to hole up inside because it was starting to get dark out. They're going to give the other car a couple more hours to show up and in the meantime figure out which way they needed to go under the cover of darkness. Not that Tully and the boys were very worried about the law. Out here in Crooked Neck, they were likely as safe as they ever could be. Most of the local goofs were scared of ghosts. And even those that weren't, no one knew this place was out here. Which wasn't exactly true anymore. Sheriff Kresge had gotten a lot of info out of that driver, including specific directions on how to find this garage through the woods while avoiding driving on Crooked Neck altogether. So the crooks, they're holed up in the garage, and before long, they hear the rumble of an engine out in the darkness. They kill their lights, keep still, and carefully take looks outside, but they don't see anything. And maybe it's in their heads, because they all grew up hearing about Earl Joe. Tully had only met his alleged old man a couple of times, who had actually taken him out to this very garage where he sat and watched Earl Joe work on engines. To kill time, the boys looked around the place, and despite the legends, there was no satanic hoo-ha, there were no black magic altars or buried bodies, anything like that. This was a hillbilly gearhead shack. There were boxes of stolen car parts, Confederate flags, a few beer-spattered nudie mags. And then that prowling engine came back. It sounded a little different this time. The lads all went back to the front window, feeling a little bolder after the first time. They saw Sheriff Kresge in his demolition derby station wagon idling out front. They barely had time to scurry away from that window before he drove right the hell through it into the front of the cabin, right into the living room. "I'd turn myself in, boys," Kresge shouted to them. As he's backing out, he used his cigar to light up a stick of dynamite and just tossed it out the passenger window. "You think Don Kresge played games? He was elected sheriff because he was the only son of a bitch crazier than the crooks and the moonshiners. After that, he started spinning donuts around the yard, tossing out half sticks of TNT, tearing that house apart splinter by splinter." Three boys all lit out from the house, diving into the same car. But from across that firelit yard, Kresge could tell that none of them were carrying guns or money, so he edged his car up on them, flicked on the brights, and aimed a gun out the window at them. But they'd suckered him. As Kresge was focused on them, Tully had snuck into his own car, and he plowed right into the side of Kresge's driver's side door. Had it been any other car, the sheriff would have been done then and there. As it stood, it only jostled him enough to make him drop his cigar. But it gave the other cars a couple of seconds to get away, and they whipped out through the woods down a dirt road. Kresge dropped into gear and followed. He followed them. They tore through tiny pathways, hacked through the deep forest, so narrow that sticks and branches were slapping at the rearview mirrors on both sides. They were bats out of hell, two getaway cars, bumper to bumper, Kresge trailing behind in his monstrous station wagon. The trail split in two, and Tully dropped away from behind the lead car and veered left. Kresge stayed with the Hendershot boy. If there was anybody calling the shots with this gang, it was Tully. Tully erupted out of the underbrush and lands in the middle of the dirt road they called Crooked Neck. He pulls right hard and sees Kresge somehow coming out behind him and keeping up with him. Up ahead are his boys in the other car, about 100 yards up. Only he's catching up to him fast. The other car, it's slowing down for some reason and now drifting off to the side of the road. Tully slid around it easily and takes a quick glance over as he passes by. He sees that the windshield and the front half of the roof are both missing, just sheared away. And inside, all three bodies are also sheared away. They're just basically legs and laps sitting in the seats. Everything above the waist just stripped like wires. Tully hesitates just for a second and Kresge smashes into him from the back. Tully's fighting for control, whipping back and forth in the dirt, and Kresge stays right on his ass, using those demo derby skills. And when Tully's wheels catch just enough leverage, turn sideways for the car to flip on its side, Kresge hits it again, T-bones it, flips it. When Kresge sees Tully crawling out of his wreckage on his belly, he gets out of the car himself. But then he sees something behind him. A muscle car outfitted with spikes and saw blades. The word kill down the side, idling about a quarter mile back, just watching him. "Is that you, Earl Joe?" Kresge asked to no one in particular. Calmly lit up another cigar, picked up a couple more half sticks of dynamite, and whipped his car around to face the kill car. There was a quarter mile straightaway between the two of them, going head on, face to face, the ultimate game of chicken. Of course, Kresge was fully planning on cheating. 50 yards out, 50 yards head to head from Earl Joe, he used that cigar to light up both of those half sticks of TNT, cut the wheel, and tossed them through the window. He slams the brake, skids to a halt. Of course, Earl Joe also cheated, because being dead, a spirit of vengeance, or whatever the hell he was, the kill car plowed right through those two fireballs. And when he hit Kresge's demo derby station wagon, the sheriff's lit cigar fell out of his mouth and into that box of TNT, and everything went up. It was the closest thing to a mushroom cloud that West Virginia has ever seen. Big enough that half mile down the road, Tully stopped running and looked back to watch it in the night sky. He was holding $20,000 under his jacket. And right up ahead was the last turn in Crooked Neck, where it straightened out and met the edge of the pavement at Highway 31. Then he heard the growl of an unholy engine, and he saw the kill car, still glowing with embers and dripping with burning gas and oil, rumbling closer and closer. Tully stopped. He held up his hands. "Dad," he says, "it's me. It's Tully." Kill car kicked up rooster tails of red dirt as it surged forward and impaled Tully Hendershot on that spiked cowcatcher, because father or son be damned, blood be damned, legacy be damned, money be damned. If you race the neck, you win or you die. Cannibal Run. They had come to her about a month ago with the offer. Huge money. Big fame. 50 thou just to show up. 10 times that amount were she to win. And assuming that drones worked out at Crooked Neck, this was going to be broadcast to black market betting parlors all over the world. She would be a legend. Lurleen Stokes thought about it, said she needed to set a few things in order first, and demanded her guaranteed downside up front. $50,000 just for showing up to the race. And if she won, she'd get that number again 10 times over, because there was no race without Lurleen Stokes. Lurleen Stokes was not only the champion of Crooked Neck, but she was the only person alive who'd gone head-to-head with Earl Joe and lived to drive again. The sponsors really needed her to make the race legit. And believe you me, this was going to be a race unlike any in history. The sponsors knew all about Crooked Neck. They did very careful research about Earl Joe and the kill car and the history, and they knew the legends to be true. This was a cabal that specialized in blood sports and human hunts and death races and other violent games of chance. And this was to be their biggest event ever. They wanted to call out the most famed outlaw racers in the world and film it as they died trying to beat Earl Joe. Win or die, the kill car versus the world. 3.5 miles, that was going to be the deadliest death race of all time. Lurleen had a month to prepare for this race, and she needed every single last minute of it. She had to get her ducks in a row, you see. It's been a long time coming, and she had a whole lot of ducks. People like to say that Leadfoot Lurleen lost her mind that night, along with her foot. They said after that she got real heavy into Satanism. They said that she stalked the families of other drivers that Earl Joe had killed. Well, they said a lot of different things about her in West Virginia, but pretty soon she would set those wagging tongues with a new tale to tell, because Lurleen was not just going in to win the race. She was going in to send that son of a bitch, Earl Joe Hendershot, to hell where he belonged, for once and for all. There were 6 cars racing for the prize that day. Lurleen and her mechanic and shotgun, a husky young lady named Dawn, were the only females and the only drivers from the U.S. All the other drivers came from dirt tracks and war-torn pits of third world hell, where they really had to keep moving and keep driving as the only way to stay alive. And as she looked at her competition one by one, Lurleen saw that these weren't racers. These were warriors. For them, every race was win or die. Even with that, she still felt a little sorry for them, because they had no idea what they were up against. They all rode in modified stock cars with custom engines. Lurleen pulled up in a wrecker. She told Shotgun Dawn to send the message as soon as the starter pistol popped. And the navigator did exactly as she was told, because Dawn had been planning this day for a long while, too. They watched as a man wearing a gunny sack mask came before the drivers, waved everybody to attention, pulled out his gun, counted down, 3, 2, 1. Dawn sent the text. Lurleen pushed her prosthetic foot down on the gas, but not too hard. Her strategy didn't involve being at the front of the pack. It, in fact, involved being dead last. She had a walking foot made of lightweight plastic and carbon fiber, and that was for line dancing and going about town. But she had another one that she would strap on for races. This one was thick as a brick, with lead bones under flesh-colored leather, and it was attached to a hydraulic ankle that would crush the pedals of most cars like empty beer cans. As they round the first turn, Lurleen and Dawn are dead last by 20 car lengths at least. Which turns out to be a pretty smart plan, because by the time they get around that turn and hit the next straightaway, they see the smoking hulk of a wrecked car laying off to the side of the road, the driver hanging dead out the window. The other 4 cars were still in sight. But so was Earl Joe. The kill car had emerged to start picking them off, one by one. Lurleen reached over, grabbed Dawn's hand, gave it a little squeeze, then slid open the window in the back of the cab. Most people assumed that they were a couple because people like to talk, and Lurleen being like she was and Dawn being like she was, everybody just made the inference. In truth, the two of them had something much deeper in common, enough that they were both willing to die to win this race. Dawn climbed into the back of the wrecker. There was a harness that they had hooked up to keep her from flying out. She strapped herself in, started to get ready. She only had a few seconds, because up ahead, the kill car was taking scalps. It would burst from the brush on the right side of the road, clip a car, disappear back into the forest, and then emerge from the other side somehow, zipping in and out, leaving cars locked up, wrecked, flipping, running into each other. Not a second later, the murder machine came back up the road towards Lurleen, shredding two cars in the process. Earl Joe had never had this much blood in his grill all at one time. It was like he was driving drunk on the high of the kill, and if he noticed that wrecker lumbering down the road towards him, he didn't pay it any mind. He whipped around and went after the last two cars that were still inexplicably battling each other for the lead. God bless their idiot souls. They were bumping and jockeying, eyes only on the money, not on their rear view, where hell was a-coming. Earl Joe left their wreckage as a flaming roadblock in the center of Crooked Neck, which didn't make Lurleen bat an eye. That's why she had a wrecker. Slow and steady was going to win this race. The wrecker entered into the last set of breakneck turns. That harness held Dawn good and tight. And when the kill car emerged for the last competitor, when it pulled up alongside the wrecker, Dawn smiled at it like a maniac. She cracked open the flare she was holding in her hand and flipped open a wooden crate with the other. Inside, it was filled with sticks of TNT, homemade, hand-rolled, just like her father used to make. You see, Don Kresge Jr. never felt like a male, and as soon as he was legally old enough, he changed his name to Dawn and started a new life as a woman. Dawn's old man had never understood her, but he'd always tried his best to love her and accept her, and Dawn loved the old man back just as hard. And let me tell you this, love doesn't have a gender, and neither does vengeance. Dawn Kresge tossed a stick of dynamite at the kill car. It bounced off the hood, exploded off to the side, but that explosion made the death car swerve and stutter and pull back. So she tossed another and another, and hot damn if it didn't work and that demonic old Ford didn't start backing off and swerve and disappear into the woods. Dawn kept throwing TNT anyway, just to flex on him. The wrecker was now pulling into the last straightaway. Half mile ahead was that final gentle curve that led to the edge of the paved highway, the finish line for the cannibal run. And there, Lurleen could see the people waiting for her. So she jammed her lead foot down on the gas, locked it into place, and prayed that hole had been dug. Remember when I said that Lurleen got heavy into Satanism? It wasn't because she started becoming a devil worshiper. It was because she knew who she was going up against. If she wanted to beat a driver out of hell, she needed to know how to fight hell. In the back, Dawn released the cable on the winch and picked up the hook at the end. This was a special hook. It was etched with symbols and runes. It had been blessed at a black mass by a defrocked priest, and was imprinted with the sort of magics and spells that were used to trap and bind invasive spirits. Lurleen had used her money and her contacts to get the one thing that might be able to latch on to an invincible kill car. Dawn had been practicing. She'd practiced the throw 1,000 times. And she threw that sumbitchin' hook right through Earl Joe's windshield, where it dug into the steering wheel. The kill car swerved and pulled, belching hellfire from under the hood. It was like a bull shark caught up on 100-pound test. Lurleen downshifted and held the wheel with everything she had to keep the wrecker on the road, because he was pulling. Dawn released some slack on the cable and then reached down for another stick of dynamite to finish him off. Impossibly, the kill car surged forward and smashed into the back of the wrecker. It was enough of an impact where Dawn dropped that stick of dynamite, which had been lit, and it just barely rolled over the edge when it went off. A shockwave hit the side of the wrecker hard. Earl Joe hit it even harder and managed to push that wrecker up and over onto its side. That last gentle curve in the road was dead ahead, like 50 feet away. But Lurleen had lost control and was skidding to a halt. The kill car whipped past, skidding out of control, hitting the brakes. The cable connecting the two snapped. Earl Joe skidded to a halt in the middle of the road, just feet away from the edge of the highway, and just inches away from the edge of a hole that was waiting for him, a grave the size of a car that had been dug just for him. Remember when I said Lurleen had been stalking the families of Earl Joe's other victims? Well, that's a half-truth. She'd been meeting with them, talking with them, recruiting them. With their combined resources, they'd put together a double-sized work crew with 28 men, 2 excavators, and 3 cement mixers. They'd worked over the plan a few times, and everything had been in place. Dawn sent them a text at the start of the race, where they quickly dug a pit at the exact spot where their crooked neck met the edge of the highway, the pavement where Earl Joe was powerless. And so there he was, and it was close. It was so close. But the kill car managed to stop in time. Came to a halt with the shotgun side wheels literally gripping the corner at the edge of the pit. Standing on the road, the workmen were just slack-jawed. Most of them didn't actually believe the kill car was real, but here it was. Lurleen and Dawn picked themselves up and just stood there watching as the kill car started to crank its wheels. There was a guttural sound, a hellhound bassando, and it was impossible to tell if it was the car making the noise or if it was coming out of the broken face of Earl Joe that was staring at them through the windshield that Dawn had broke. He stared at him, seething rage, hands blood slick on the wheel, and it was, for lack of a better way to put it, it was one of those moments where time stopped. There were 1,000 sounds, but for a second, everything was quiet. There were 1,000 foul smells, but for a second, they cleared. And Dawn, she smelled something so familiar. She still had 1 last stick of TNT with her, in her hand. She had always rolled them up twisted at the ends like a joint, the way her old man had taught her. And that's when it came to her, the memory, that smell. It hit home. She remembered those cheap gas station cigars that Don Kresge had smoked. He kept them in a mug on top of the piano. They smelled so bad that her mother had forbidden him from smoking in the house. Lurleen patted her pockets looking for a lighter. Dawn held out her hand. And then she felt, just for a second, a strong grip slipping something into her palm. Lurleen tried to hand over the lighter, and Dawn looked down and saw one of those cheap gas station cigars in the palm of her hand. It was half-smoked and still smoldering. Dawn got the tingles. Lurleen got the tingles. Hell, I wasn't even there. I'm sort of getting the tingles my own self. Dawn lit her last stick of TNT off the nub of her father's last cigar and tossed it through the broken windshield. The kill car burst into flames from inside out, and then it toppled over and down and slid into the pit. On cue, all three cement mixers opened fire, and three sluices of blacktop came pouring down into the hole, filling it up with several tons of Earl Joe's biggest weakness. Lurleen and Dawn just sat and watched and shared the rest of that cigar. And when the work was done and the pavement had been smoothed out, it just looked like there had been a slight addition to the road, to the intersection of the highway and Crooked Neck. The only thing that was slightly odd about it, and most people would never even notice this, was the scorched, snapped end of a tow cable that was sticking out of the cement. And next to it, written by fingertip, were the eternal words, "Here lies Earl Joe Hendershot, former champion of Crooked Neck." Thank you for listening to another episode of A Scary Home Companion. I hope you enjoyed Hellbound and Down, the Kill Car Trilogy, because it's coming soon to Sci-Fi Channel, like it or not. A lot of great music this episode. Two different songs by Devil Music. The third song you heard was by Pistol Jazz, a great little tune called Godspeed. And coming up still, Why You Crying by Not the Ones. Thanks to my producer, Jeff Davidson. He's actually the one that pitched the idea for the Cannibal Run. After I heard that title, how could I say no? Please subscribe to the podcast on Buzzsprout, on iTunes, or click that little heart next to it on Spotify. Feedback is always welcome. Send it to ascaryhomecompanion@gmail.com. Find me on Facebook under that name or on Twitter under the name Nateflix.
I used to roll a Chevrolet until I had to step my game up. Now I roll a Benz, throwing up my middle finger. Laughing, smashing past your ass in traffic, switching lanes. And your girl was trying to tap you just to ask you what my name is.
Fuck that dude, he ain't shit.
Is what you're yelling, but it's hard for her to hear you when I got my engine revving. While you're spending time worrying about the price of gas, I got the pedal to the metal rolling twice as fast. With no destination in particular, just keeping it vehicular. Peace sign with the missing lines, the insignia. Screeching tires when I leave the spot is my signature. You couldn't run me off the road if you drove a pickup truck. Give it up smooth when I come through. 1-2-0
miles an hour so everybody sees you.
We drop hip rides, we don't fuck with Volvos. 120 miles an hour speeding on you slow boats. You should've known when we roll that it's no joke. Put your money down, fuck around and you go broke. We drop hip rides, we don't fuck with Volvos. 120 miles an hour speeding on you slow boats. You should've known when we roll that it's no joke. Put your money down, fuck around and you go broke.
Cruising down the street in my Millennium Falcon. That's super fly shit, I didn't get it in Galpin. If you wanna ride, you better get in with cow shit.
I know you wanna eat it, but a minute it's
I mean awesome, I'm bossing and flossing. The cop pulled me over, said how much did it cost, man? I said you wouldn't believe it, he said damn. I said that's what you need to ride this fly, my man. He said you could go, young G, what it do? Because if I had that ride, I was feeding it too. I'm beating your crew on the racetrack, face facts. I paid 300 G's just in state tax. Baby, lay back, the seat reclines.
We drop hip rides, we don't fuck with Volvos. 120 miles an hour speeding on you slow boats. You should've known when we roll that it's no joke. Put your money down, fuck around and you go broke. We drop hip rides, we don't fuck with Volvos. 120 miles an hour speeding on you slow boats. You should've known when we roll that it's no joke. Put your money down, fuck around and you go broke.
For some roadside assistance, that's probably when you witness me roll by with a quickness. I'm so fly when I'm dipping, my dope riding, I'm shifting your whole block with my system. You know why, cause I'm getting it. You couldn't pass a smog check, your alignment's offset. My ride's a science project, I'm so on deck. These parking lot pimps ain't talking about shit. I'm about to pop a hood and show them what I'm fucking.
My car's
with.
Back to the future on some Marty McFly shit. You got a car that you can hardly get by with. My ride's a hybrid, ridiculous and mean, and I keep the inside of it meticulously clean. The outside. It's pristine, it's a killer car like Christine. You had the same white machine since you were 16. A lime green 87 Datsun. That's why when I roll up, your ladies yelling shotgun.